I'm Charles Lane, but virtually all of you know that, and I want to tell you how much I appreciate the fact that you keep coming back, especially with the competition we've got from Ted tonight. And tonight's topic is enigmatically called CO2 the Switch. And who is a first-timer here tonight? Are you here for the first time? We actually have a few first-timers here tonight. Well, thank you for showing up. The rest of this crowd has been some regulars that have been here all week long. For whatever reason.
He really did. Last week when he did this, he had this core of ladies that just followed him. So it really was a man club.
But I deeply appreciate the fact that all of you come back, and whenever Dish Detail allows you, to come back and hear some of this. For those of you who are first timing it, though, I'm by profession a geologist, and I'm chair of the geology department at Hardin-Simmons University, buried deep in the heart of Texas. Made the long trip up here to do this, and they wanted me to come talk about different kinds of environmental issues. And this week's discussion has been on, where did I put my backpack?
Everyone's here.
Everyone's here now that Anna showed up. Our Duluth connection is back amongst us. But the discussion this week is basically centered on this book, which I asked the bookstore to get their hands on, The Next 100 Years Shaping the Fate of Our Living Earth. And that's from where our living earth came. As part of the title. And the book is a very readable, right? You've been kind of carrying along with this. A very readable, delightfully readable treatment of how we first started thinking about global warming as an issue. So basically this week has been dedicated to considerations of global warming. What it is, how reliable we think the data are, since that's plural. Datum being singular, and where we're going to go with this. And I've tried to, over the course of the week, get a great deal into the nature of interdependencies of what we call the Earth's spheres, the atmosphere, the hydrosphere, the lithosphere, the sphere of the crust of the Earth, the biosphere. And those of you who've been with me for a while know that we've gone through various examples of how the spheres interact, how a volcanic eruption, which is a lithospheric event, if you will, affects the atmosphere to the effect that it moderates climate, which then affects the biosphere. And we've gone through a number of examples of those kinds of things. Hopefully, those of you who've been carrying along for the course of the week have developed a better appreciation of the interdependent and interrelated nature of all of the Earth's spheres. And tonight, I'm going to kind of take a little different tack. I'm going to focus very much on the business of carbon dioxide. You've all heard about it. You've all known about it as a greenhouse gas, as a principal culprit in global warming. It's actually even more important than that. And that's what we're going to focus on tonight. And so the first thing I want to do, and again, those of you who have been with me a while, this is going to be kind of in the nature of a recap, but for those of you who are coming here the first time, just want to run through some of this stuff for just a moment. First, the business of the greenhouse effect itself on a global basis. I don't know if they've decided they want to come this way or not. There's probably run out of seats next door. But on the global basis, if this is our fair planet, and I only put down parts of North and South America, but you get the idea. And Mr. Sun is over here shining madly away and having a good time with it. The radiation that comes from the sun to the earth comes in the form of visible light, among other things, and comes with a certain amount of energy. If we're going to be like physicists, we'll talk about the wavelength of light that comes in and hits the surface of the earth, Earth's atmosphere, warms us, drives the entire planet, all the patterns of clouds. We talked about the Coriolis effect, some of you were here a couple times ago. The Earth must re-radiate that energy back into space or burn up. So we have to re-radiate that energy, only it gets re-radiated at a... Is that looking sufficiently different? Let me draw a little bit differently. It gets re-radiated back into space at lower energies, longer wavelengths. And you've heard about that in terms of infrared. You've heard of infrared radiation. The problem is that there are gases in the atmosphere that let the shorter wavelength, higher energy stuff in, but don't let the longer wavelength, lower energy stuff out. Now, the Earth's atmosphere is composed principally of N2 and O2, nitrogen oxide,
oxygen.
I feel much better. I'm so pleased that an officer of the law is going to come up here instead of working on sin and all that sort of stuff.
That's too much like war damage.
You can't really get away from that stuff. So anyway, and again, those of you who've been with me for a while, oxygen and nitrogen make up 99% of the Earth's atmosphere, and they're what we call diatomic molecules. Oops. N to N, O to O. They're molecules made up of two atoms. They are invisible to the radiation coming from the sun. They are invisible to the radiation that's re-radiated from the Earth back into space. Invisible, just passes right through, no biggie. But once you go to three molecules, then you have a greenhouse gas. If you go to water vapor, H2O, if you go to OCO, CO2, if you go to OOO, ozone, and others, right? We can do this. We put out plenty of other pollutants into the atmosphere. We can have OSO, which is going to be sulfur dioxide. We can go ONO. You see how this works? I mean, these are all these triads, all of these things that come in threes. All of these things constitute very nice greenhouse gases. They are invisible to the Earth's or to the sun's energy coming to Earth, but they are in at least part opaque to the energy being re-radiated back to space. It gets trapped. And of course, if we start adding gases with more and more molecules, it gets even worse. Once we go to the business of here's our methane. Again, for some of those who've been with me, we've done this. Methane, CH4. If we strip off the H's and add chlorines and fluorines, we get chlorofluorocarbons. Okay? All of these things, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 molecules, these are even worse greenhouse gases. What they do is they take that re-radiated energy in the infrared coming back from the surface there, and they just shoot it off into the atmosphere instead of letting it pass up and back out into space. Okay? So this configuration and variations thereof, basically to make chlorofluorocarbons, all you do is strip these hydrogens off of here and add other things. And as Dana Lynn can tell you, if you let this thing float around in the atmosphere for a while, it will oxidize, it will combine with oxygen, but when it does, you put hydrogen together with oxygen, you get H2O, and you put carbon together with oxygen, you get carbon dioxide, so you're still in bad shape. So, a primer on greenhouse gases. Okay? Just a short primer on greenhouse gases. And all of them contributing in their own way to global warming. Okay? So, kind of a quick recap on some of that. Now, carbon dioxide is one you hear a great deal about. Very much a part of the natural landscape, right? Very much a part of the natural landscape. Those of you with me a day or so ago, we talked about cycles. I'd like to talk a little bit about cycles again. Let's get the mountains of the Northwest and running back down toward the ocean. And of course, this is the wasteland that we're looking south.
this is the wasteland of eastern Washington over here, right?
Richland. Pasco.
You don't believe me, yeah? Just ask. The wastelands of eastern Washington. Now, things cycle in nature. Carbon is part of us, right? Part of our own constitution. There is so much. One of the things that you need to realize is that with the exception of a little hydrogen and a little helium, nothing comes to Earth from outer space in the form of matter or gets away from Earth back into outer space. Now, energy, yeah, that's a different thing. But in terms of matter, the carbon that we have here on planet Earth and in the Earth's atmosphere stays here. Doesn't leave, go out of space, doesn't come back. So it cycles. CO2 in the air, right? And that's what we're talking about, is carbon dioxide being in the air. There's actually some CO2 dissolved in water. There's also some CO3, which we call carbonate, which is also in water, which, by the way, is a lot more common if you put it in other terms. All invertebrate life forms, with the exception of echinoids and those kinds of things, but clams, oysters, you got to grind them up to get lime out of them, right? Lime is a fairly unusual material in this part of the country with all these volcanic rocks, so you got to go harvest clams. They're made up of calcium carbonate, so CO3 ties up a lot of carbon in the world's oceans. We tie up a fair amount of carbon in our bodies here on land, but of course the big carbon sink on land is the vegetation, especially the Earth's forests. It ties up a lot of carbon. So we can think about this stuff cycling around. You cut down the trees, you burn them, you let them rot in the forest, and actually they're going to release carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. They also will take in the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere in order to make up our photosynthetic cycle. Okay? We have on this planet a great deal of carbon stored in the place where we really want it. We want it stored in places like this. It's where we really would like to see it stored rather than in the atmosphere. Okay? Carbon cycle. So, how did we get to this point? I mean, I don't think that I've really said a whole lot to you so far that's, you know, maybe it's danced a little bit out on the edge of your conscious thought. But, you know, the whole business of carbon dioxide, and we don't want to cut down trees in the rainforest, we know that's bad, that kind of thing. I mean, that you probably didn't need me to tell you much of anything like that. But where did we get to this kind of understanding? Where did, you know, how did we get to a point of being so concerned about this carbon dioxide in the atmosphere in the first place? The history of this is amazingly short. And one of the principal characters in this book is a fellow by the name of Charles Keeling. Now you know because you've read the book. Who else has ever heard of Charles Keeling? Besides you, you've read the book as well. Daniel Lynn, does that name ring any bells? Doesn't ring any bells at all, does it? Charles Keeling is almost single-handedly responsible for us knowing about carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Almost single-handedly. Now, I will immediately put a few caveats on that. There have been people in the last century who studied carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and we'll come back to them in a moment. But Charles Keeling finished up his PhD in chemistry from Northwestern University in Chicago, Evanston actually, back in the mid-50s, decided that he didn't much care for Chicago, that he wanted to be anywhere the Rocky Mountains west, and ended up going to Caltech. Once he got to Caltech, he was sitting in on one of those bull sessions that faculty have, no matter what institution they're in.
in which the department chair was talking about carbon dioxide in water and air and whether or not they're in some kind of a balance. And it struck Keeling as something that would be interesting to check out. He was going to go measure the amounts of carbon dioxide dissolved in water in a stream, because the reason he went west was to stay outdoors. He was a chemist who didn't like working in the lab. That's how he became a geochemist, is by doing that. So at any rate, the idea was he's going to measure carbon dioxide in water, and he's going to measure in a stream, and he's going to measure carbon dioxide in the air right above it and see if it's the same amounts of carbon dioxide, basically. And this was 1954, 1955. This was not that long ago. There are some of you in the room old enough to remember 1954 and 55. Although you won't admit it. Some of you don't have a chance of coming close, Lindsay. But at any rate, not that long ago, in the grand scheme of things. Well, Charles Keeling never did finish up that particular experiment. He never did finish it up. He spent a few years perfecting the device that he needed to measure carbon dioxide in the air. And when he started measuring carbon dioxide in the air, he started measuring in places like Yosemite, which I would too. Why not? Let's go conduct a scientific experiment in Yosemite. Sounds like a plan to me. And he was just interested to see if his device would work. Now, those of you who were here with me yesterday, I told a little bit of this story, but he found something extraordinary when he was in Yosemite. He found out that the carbon dioxide levels were different during the course of the day. He found out that the carbon dioxide levels in the air took a big drop through the morning hours when the sun came up and when the plants were starting their photosynthesis process, pulling the carbon dioxide out of the air. And then, later on, after the carbon dioxide had been taken in and the sugars had been created and the plants were basically living off of this, burning it, if you will, and that's truly the case, oxidation. We're oxidizing that potato we just ate right now, as a matter of fact. And he saw that during the course of 24 hours, the carbon dioxide levels went up and down and up and down in the forest, and he was watching the forest breathe by watching the carbon dioxide levels. He's watching the forest breathe. And this fascinated him. And then he got in the business of, I'm going to measure carbon dioxide. He is still at Caltech. He is still measuring carbon dioxide. He has never done anything else. He has never done anything else. He also found out along the way that in the spring and early summer in the northern hemisphere, when photosynthesis is going crazy throughout all of that growing stuff all around the northern hemisphere, the carbon dioxide levels went down because the plants were taking it in. And he found in the fall, when all the leaves fell off and were decaying on the forest floor, that all that carbon dioxide was being released. He was actually watching the planet breathe. But the thing that was most disturbing to him was that every year he was watching the carbon dioxide level go up. The average carbon dioxide level in the atmosphere go up. When he first started out back in the 54, 55 period of time, carbon dioxide level in the atmosphere was about 315 parts per million. And he watched it go up every year. It's now in excess of about 350 parts per million, as a matter of fact. And this started a train of thought for him as to what this might possibly mean in terms of its effect on the global environment, because he knew it was a greenhouse gas. He knew it was a greenhouse gas because he got real interested in the study of carbon dioxide, and he went back to some of the 18th century, or the 1800s, 19th century scientists who'd been studying it, because there were a few. And in the 1900s, a couple of people, British physicist Tyndall I think is how you pronounce it. Arrhenius is the way I've heard that pronounced. Is that the way you've heard that pronounced for his name? Never heard it before. Made a couple of extraordinary statements. Same statements, two different guys. They were looking at carbon dioxide and they were saying, maybe we can use carbon dioxide to heat the atmosphere to spare us the ravages of our immediate past. Now, again, those of you who have been here a time or two, the ravages of the immediate past were the tail end of the Little Ice Ages. And, you know, I've come back to different things at different times all around this week. But the Little Ice Ages that affected Europe didn't finally finish off until the early 1800s, 1811, 1812. And then, of course, to bring in another thing that we've touched on, the Mount Tambora eruption of 1815 that produced the year without a summer in 1816 when it snowed in New England in July. The earth was cold. Winters were cold. And Tyndall and Arrhenius were speculating on the fact that the Industrial Revolution of the middle 1800s and burning coal and a lot more wood would warm up the atmosphere to the point where we would never have to worry about an ice age descending on us again. And from their perspective, it made perfectly good sense. But they never did think about the other side of that. It just never occurred to them to think about the other side of that. What if you're not in an ice age? What if you're in a warm period and you keep on putting this stuff in? It never occurred to them. Okay. Well, Keeling started thinking about this and wondering about this. And he got a certain boost in terms of his perspective on this from NASA. As a matter of fact, looking at other planets. Okay, ready for some astronomy? She doesn't know if she wants to have any of this or not. All right, here. Now this is going to be an easy one for you. Of course, if you can't get it, then you're going to be really embarrassed.
Yeah. Okay, that's the sun.
That's the sun.
Okay, now.
Mercury. Venus. Earth. Mars.
That's all. I ran out of board. We can't get the rest of the solar system. The inner planets, the Terran planets of the solar system, through various lines of evidence, we've got a pretty good handle that they're all of a very similar composition. Now, the Jovian planets, once you get out to Jupiter and Saturn, on out the big gaseous planets, something else again, we've got a pretty fair handle. They're basically made up of the same kinds of materials in the four inner planets. Venus is about 67 million miles from the sun on average. Earth is about 93 million miles from the sun on average. And Mars is out here about 170 million miles from the sun on average. You probably didn't realize that we were that much closer to Venus than Mars, right? Mm-hmm. We're actually a whole lot closer to Venus than we are to Mars. But nonetheless, these are all Terran-type planets, rocky, metallic cores to these planets, as opposed to the Jovian planets. And the information we've got back from various lines of evidence, principally astronomical, is that they basically have the same kind of composition. Now, some of you, especially those of you who are astronomy buffs and follow the escapades of NASA over the years, know that there have actually been some probes, not just by NASA, there have been some probes to both of the planets, right? The Russians actually put a lander on Venus. Remember that? That was back 70s, I think, mid-late 70s. The Russians actually put a lander on Venus. They had enormous parachutes, and the lander was built a little better than most of their nuclear submarines. And it lived for about 4 or 5 hours in the Venetian atmosphere. it lived long enough to send back photographs of where it was sitting. And it's kind of famous photographs. You can see the foot pad of the lander kind of there in the photograph, and this kind of rocky-looking surface underneath. But there wasn't anything else to see. The atmosphere was just pea soup. And the 4 or 5 hour life expectancy was actually what the Soviets had expected for their lander. We, of course, sent landers to Mars and lived for a great deal longer period of time and sent back some of those great photographs of that red, rocky landscape that you've probably seen before. Two totally different worlds. Venus, with a temperature of 450 degrees centigrade in its atmosphere, which is up to 950,000 degrees Fahrenheit, plenty warm. 450 degrees C. Mars out here, the other end of the spectrum, really, never even coming close to temperature of Antarctica on its worst day. Any idea what the temperature of Antarctica on its worst day is?
Around negative 20. I'm just guessing.
Sure. That's, well, contrary to what Minnesotans say, International Falls is not the coldest place on the planet. It's about 127 degrees below Fahrenheit. So you see?
That's Mars?
No, that is Vostok Station, Antarctica. 127 below. See, it's never got that cold in the booth.
Is that a bad day or a normal day?
That's a record.
That's the record.
That's the record. That's the record. Although there's a few days that push it. So, it seemed to me it was only appropriate that, you know, Russia, Siberia, all that big cold north country, they ought to have the station in Antarctica that's the coldest as well. It seems sort of, there's a symmetry there about that. Vostok actually comes back into the equation here after a while, though, with some important information. But at any rate, and I'm not sure of the exact numbers, but it seems like the warmest it gets in Mars is still a number of degrees colder than this. I mean, not a whole lot, but 150 or 180 degrees below or something like that. In Venus, the atmosphere has several hundred times more carbon dioxide in it than what the Earth's atmosphere does. And in Mars, the atmosphere virtually doesn't exist, which is why it's so cold. And the carbon dioxide is actually locked up in the soil and actually in those frozen Martian poles. Those poles are not water, those poles are carbon dioxide. Mm-hmm. Frozen carbon dioxide. The astronomers would tell us that Venus, Earth, and Mars have about the same amount of carbon. Venus and the Earth and Mars have originally the same amount of carbon. The question is, where do you put it? In Venus, it is virtually all in the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And in Mars, virtually none of it is in the atmosphere. By the way, if you were to have an Earth-like atmosphere on Venus or Mars, we could work at colonizing. The temperature differences, I mean, we're only 30 million miles away from Venus. Some of the astronomers have done some work on it, some calculations on that, and if it had an Earth-like atmosphere, we would not be too close to the sun. So it's the distance to the sun is not the factor. It's not the point. It's where you put the carbon is the point. So at any rate, the astronomers got into it at this point in time, and of course, who else but Carl Sagan jumps in to give us his 2 cents worth on the whole thing, and starts talking about the problems of a runaway greenhouse. And That gets everybody working overtime and looking at the Keeling curve. And so here's mathematicians among us will enjoy this. Nice XY graph. Do you know what classes he teaches, Lindsay?
High school math.
Algebra 1 and 2. No, I don't want to hear you that. Ask Dana Lynn. She likes math. No, I got to have more help from you than that. I'm trying to hold up female role models to empower my daughters. You're supposed to say the calculus was a snap. So the calculus wasn't a snap?
No, I'm not much of a math person.
But you got through the calculus.
Yeah, I got through it. Okay.
And it got through with you at the same
Maybe
time.
Maybe she met a new guy there.
That's it. That's
what?
It.
Maybe met a nice guy there.
In the calculus.
Yeah.
CO2 levels versus time. CO2 levels versus time. And this is Keeling's curve. And of course, it's looking something like this. But it starts in 1958. 57 and 58, by the way, it's called the IGY, International Geophysical Year. And it kicked off a whole lot of things in terms of scientific endeavor. And one of the first and foremost was the offshore drilling program, where the earth scientists were busy drilling deep ocean basins and retrieving all that kind of information. This is when a great many of the scientific stations in Antarctica were set up on Greenland, this kind of thing. So this was kind of an auspicious start for Keeling to keep track of all of his data. Keeling keeps track of his data from a vast number of different places around the world. His favorite place for tracking carbon dioxide levels is on top of Mauna Loa in Hawaii, which, hey, why not? Actually, Keeling doesn't go there very often, but the people who work for him are up there on top of Mauna Loa. And of course, the idea is that you're 2,500 miles away from anywhere out there in the middle of the Pacific, and it's going to be the most representative sample of the Earth's CO2 level that you're likely to get it away from the nearby smokestack or something. That's provided, of course, that Mauna Loa doesn't blow up anytime soon.
Aren't the active volcanoes? They
sure, they're active volcanoes. And he is upwind of Kilauea, basically. So he's managed to keep away from Kilauea. But it's kind of an interesting deal. The atmospheric chemists and physicists are all parked on top of Mauna Loa. The astronomers are all parked up over on top of Mauna Kea, the other one of those twin volcanoes. But he gets data from there. He gets data from way up in the wilds of Alaska. And he also gets data from various of the Antarctic stations and from those scientists who actually enjoy going out on the Greenland ice cap. It takes a different type of person, obviously. But at any rate, he has been tracking this rate of CO2 increase, because that's all he was ever interested in. He didn't care about methane, he didn't care about CFCs and stuff. He's a very single-minded person. He's been tracking CO2 and watching it rise. The question would come up is, I mean, what does this mean? If you see it rising, but where was it and where is it going to go? I mean, you've got record from 1958 to 1992 now. Where was it before? Where's it going to go? In other words, your database is too limited. You can't tell us that there's a greenhouse effect going on the basis of this, because you don't know how high it might rise naturally. You don't know how low it might be naturally. There's too much noise. Of course, this is, I think, kind of an ironic statement for people who attack Keeling to talk about there's too much human-induced noise in here for you to get a legitimate reading. Saying, well, it's the human-induced factor that we're most concerned about. So Keeling's curve has come under attack from various quarters over the years as not being a long enough line, not enough data to mean anything. Reintroduce the cryosphere.
This was 2 weeks ago. I'm finishing my second week of this stuff now. 2 weeks ago, start of the week, why we were working on the geology of the Pacific Northwest, talking about glaciers and volcanoes and all this sort of stuff. But I introduced the term cryosphere, which is the sphere of ice. Scientists now break out the hydrosphere from the cryosphere, the Earth's waters from the Earth's ice. And the cryosphere has been great fun to study for geologists and climatologists because the ice ages are such a kick. And you guys have all enjoyed it because you've read Genol and you've done Plains of Passage and, you know, Clan of the Cave Bear. You didn't ever read Clan of the Cave Bear, did you?
I don't know.
But my wife reads Clan of the Cave Bear and all of a sudden, you've read Clan of the Cave Bear.
It's,
yeah. Daryl Hannah is great. Yes. Yes, one of the you know, top quality actresses of our time. At any rate, Daryl Hannah in a movie that doesn't require her to speak. Yes. Actually, no, I like Daryl Hannah. I like Roxanne just fine. But at any rate, the cryosphere has been a lot of fun for climatologists and geologists to study because it carves this scenery we've seen around here. I mean, what's not to like? Mm-hmm. It's been great fun. But the cryosphere is also one of the world's great record keepers. I made this point on a couple other occasions, but we'll come back to it again now. The cryosphere is the world's great record keeper because that snowfall that has turned to glacial ice contains lots of things from our past. In fact, glaciers, that glacier ice, is about 10% air anyway. It's even more than that in snow, but glacial ice is 10% air. Wiener tells of an interesting experience he had when he went to, I think it was in Germany, but he might as well have gone to Buffalo, New York, which is where the great refrigeration plants are. And the scientists rented the second floor to put their ice cores in because that's where all of the prime lobsters are also put to freeze them. Believe it or not, scientists go to Antarctica and to Greenland and they set up a drill rig and they core the ice for thousands and thousands and thousands of feet. And they pull these cores out, put them in boxes, and ship them to Buffalo, New York. Save them there because there is a gold mine, a treasure trove of information in the ice. The thing about the air, what they'll do, and Wiener described it almost as a religious, mystical kind of experience. They took a block of ice, and what they do is they put it in a chamber where they evacuate all the air, and then they crush the ice to release the air that's trapped in there. But they did this for Wiener, and he was sitting there breathing at the time, and it was almost religious for him because he was breathing air that nobody had breathed for 15,000 years. But the ice record tells us a host of things. It tells us some of the great volcanic eruptions of the past. It tells us about sunspot activity of the past. It tells us when the first radioactive fallout came from the Nevada test site tests. We're talking about stuff in Antarctica and Greenland now. It's in the ice. Not only that, the world's carbon dioxide levels and the world's temperature variations are in the ice. And they're in the ice for 160,000 years in the past.
How is temperature variation on the ice?
Good question. It has to do, and I'm going to give you the answer too, so get ready. The temperature variations are measured on the basis of stable isotopes of oxygen. You wanted to know. Okay. Stable isotopes of oxygen. Sure. It works like this. Okay, quick chemistry lesson again, and I'll leave you alone. Remember the term isotope from physical science or chemistry class? You have a certain number of protons in a nucleus, and you're supposed to have the same number of neutrons. that's not really the case. The number of protons define what the element is, okay? But the neutrons can actually vary, okay? So with oxygen, what's the atomic number of oxygen?
16.
But at any rate, if you get more neutrons or less neutrons, then the atomic weight varies. Okay? And think of it as back in the early 50s again. The early 50s was a very interesting time in science. Back in the early 50s, there was another geochemist who had the bright idea that if you had temperature variations in the atmosphere, and the atmosphere contains oxygen, then as the atmosphere warmed up, the lighter isotopes, the ones that had less numbers of neutrons in them, would actually rise up higher in the atmosphere, and those down right next to ground level would be relatively enriched in the heavier isotopes. We've made up a way to calibrate that to temperatures. And it's a fascinating piece of work. And we can you can use a mass spectrometer to work on the oxygen isotopes and work that thing over. So the ice in the cryosphere is wonderful. It is a fantastic record. A fantastic record. And we've got it going back 160,000 years. Now,
before you erase that,
okay.
Yeah. Is that linear or is that curved? Just these years. Or is
do I want to answer that question yet? Is the thing.
Is it good? Well, then you can save it. That's fine.
Yeah, let me okay. Save it. Let me save it because 58 is kind of a crucial thing here too. All right. Now, let's expand our time scale. We'll call this P for the present, and we'll say that over here is 160,000 BP for the present. Scientists actually do that, by the way, BP, for the present. Watch this. We'll have something that looks kind of like this pattern. Down, up, down, up. I'm not doing this exactly like in the book, but I'm going to tell you that it's close. Down, up. Something like that. CO2 level, for the past 160,000 years, has fluctuated up and down. Okay. Where the CO2 level is low, okay, so down here, and down here, say, the CO2 level is low. Surprisingly enough, this curve becomes or can be made to become coincident with the temperature curves for the same period of time. In other words, I can erase this. The temperature on there, it's the same thing. CO2 and the temperature go together. These represent, and we can cross-check these by a variety of other methods, but these actually represent glacial ice advances of the ice ages, when Earth temperatures are much colder overall. And you know, we can double-check this, have double-checked this against geologic types of information, radiocarbon types of dates. We can double check it against it, and we get a check. It cross checks. But the thing is that the carbon dioxide curve and the temperature curve, and we're measuring two different things, right? Carbon dioxide, we are just looking at carbon dioxide that's trapped in these gas bubbles in the ice. The temperature curve, we're looking at oxygen in these gas bubbles. So we're looking at two different things. The curves track. And these things reflect periods where there has been glacial ice advances across the northern hemisphere. And these periods where both the temperature and the CO2 levels are higher represent, the peak of them represents what we call the ultra-thermal highest temperature in between.
That doesn't really make, I'm not just being evidence, but I just don't understand why it would work that way. Because when the temperature is low, that means that the plants aren't doing as much as when it's high. And so there should be more CO2 in the atmosphere, right? Because they're not using it up. Or, I mean, I'm assuming that there must be some other reason, but then...
If we go back to your original picture of the sun and the Earth, whereby with more carbon dioxide, the radiation did not get out. But with less carbon dioxide, more got out. So the warming was not as much, or the warming wasn't didn't stay, so therefore it didn't build.
Yeah. Well, you're going to find that as you have the lower temperatures, okay, that is a reflection of the fact that there's less CO2 in the atmosphere.
Okay, so it's the other way, so it's due to the cause of the effect.
Well, and this is kind of a tricky part to follow. You're actually anticipating one of the things I want to bring up next, okay, in terms of cause and effect. But low temperatures, low atmospheric temperatures, are going to, in essence, dovetail with low CO2 levels because you don't have greenhouse gases in the atmosphere to keep it warm. Okay.
Now, the mountain in Indonesia that erupted in 1814 or
15.
Now that produced a winter, a year-long winter. What again was it that was in the atmosphere? You said there was sulfur.
What happened?
Sulfur dioxide.
Well, the volcano emitted sulfur dioxide gas.
And that's a triton, so.
Well.
It should be a.
Actually, let me finish. It emitted the sulfur dioxide gas and water vapor. Okay? Now the sulfur dioxide gas and the water vapor get together, they produce sulfuric acid in a liquid state. Okay, now the sulfuric acid in the liquid state, all bets are off. So don't get into the triads,
okay,
don't get into the greenhouse.
That's what, I know you explained it yesterday, but
don't get into that because then the sulfuric acid in a liquid form is floating around as clouds high up in the atmosphere. And it has a high reflectivity,
okay.
So the sunlight.
Okay, and did that affect the CO2 level also?
There was
had an increase of CO2.
There was an effect because you can also pick up acids, how acidic the environment is in some of these ices. To answer your question in short, the Mount Tambora eruption shows up in the ice record as well. All right, let me drive to the point I'm trying to make here and tie it back to some of the stuff that we've done in front. Notice that there is a range here from top to bottom. Notice that we've got things bottoming out no lower than a certain point, and we've got things going no higher than a certain point. So there's a window. There is a window in which the Earth's climate has operated for the past 160,000 years. Now, we might ask ourselves the question, do we want to be part of what may be an alternating ice age? And, the problems that would be if there would be more glacial advance anytime soon. But if you would just go with it for a while as thinking that the past 160,000 years, this has been the status quo. This has been the normal mode of operation for the planet's climate. The bottom line of the window here is somewhere in the vicinity of about 180 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere. That's the bottom line of the window. The top line of the window is at best about 260 to 270 parts per million. We're out of the window. Or if you prefer the fighter pilot terminology, we're out of the envelope.
And we were already out of the window in 1958.
We were out of the window in 1958. The thing that was sort of interesting is that this data, this 160,000 year data, came from Vostok Station in Antarctica, courtesy of the Soviets. And they brought it all the way up to 1958. So they brought it to 1958, they started, this was Promontory Butte, right? This is the Golden Spike, railroad coming from east and west, and managed to make it meet at the same point. The Russians brought it from 160,000 years to 1958. Guess what their level was in 1958? 315 parts per million. Coming from there to there, and Keeling was there, and they tied in with it. Now, back to your question. You kind of reduce all of this to a first order curve of some kind. Why you can make kind of a straight line for a while, and once you get into about 1750, 1760 of the Industrial Revolution, you climb up through that 270 parts per million window at about that point in time, and you start climbing to about 1958. And about 1958, so yeah, you bring a kind of straight line segment this way, and you can get it pretty close to the linear coming here. But in 1958, it starts to go exponential.
Population, just like the whole Middle East oil fields finally developed. So the point is, we're out of the window. A long ways out of the window. And so Keeling's response, and he can be sort of abrupt from time to time, but Keeling's response is, you know, how much record do you want now? How much record do you want?
So he's worried.
He's worried.
Yeah.
He's worried. Lots of unanswered questions. I mean, there's lots of things that I could not tell you, even if I were Charles Keeling himself. Cause and effect, you know, does the CO2 change cause the temperature drop? Does the temperature drop cause CO2 change? A lot of cause and effect in there, and that's what I was talking about yesterday when I was talking about cycles and feedback loops and why we're always looking so hard for them. Because we don't have a real good handle on the cause and effect. We don't have a real good handle, as of yet, where this thing might go beyond exponential and go ballistic on us and turn into a runaway greenhouse, like Venus. But if there is a moral to the story from this and from what you see on Mars and Venus, is that you really ought to pay attention to where you put your carbon. Now, for whatever reason, the ice age is bottomed out down there in that 180 range and didn't go any farther. And we probably don't want it to see go any farther down than that. We don't want to do a Mars routine. And we certainly don't want Venus either. And so where you put your carbon, you know, becomes an extraordinarily important question. We don't know where you can go on this curve before you get to a runaway greenhouse, to the point where you couldn't stop it. In other words, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy after one. We don't know where that is. And we just don't know. We don't know if it's something that would happen in 20 years' time, in 100 years' time, which was kind of the premise of his book, that you know, we've got 100 years, in a sense, to kind of straighten this out, he thinks. We just don't know. And the argument is that we ought to take this fairly seriously and see what we can do to try and turn some of this around right now, rather than looking for more studies. This has been a very difficult issue for scientists. Speaking as one, I can tell you that any time you publish something or propose a new piece of information, it's the nature of the scientific community to just tear it to shreds. you cannot be thin-skinned at all in scientific community. It's not that people are attacking you personally, but they are going to attack your work and look for whatever the weaknesses are in it. And that's kind of the way the nature of scientific inquiry works. You propose something, and if you're going to be really honest about it, when you make your proposal, you should also tell everybody else all the ways you can think of to tear it down. And if you're going to be real honest about it, that's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to say, here's what I think, now here's the way you can attack this, so please do. You're supposed to go that far. You're not supposed to just go out and say, this is what I think, and then have them have to devise the ways to test it. And, you know, scientific community is really very cautious and very careful in that respect. And Keeling and everybody else has had a real hard time with this, because it kind of goes against their very nature to be, you know, ringing the bell and jumping up and down, being at the forefront of social causes. So this has been kind of a hard thing for the scientific community to do. But, you know, when do you have enough evidence? You know, when do you have enough evidence as to what's going on? That would be our present administration's idea, right? Let's study it some more. what's the use of collecting this data and trying to use it in a predictive sense? You're not going to pay attention to that and wait until something actually happens that you don't want to have happen before you try to deal with it. And I think that's kind of where the scientific community stands at this point in time. But we're a long ways out of the window, and that should be a reason for some kind of concern. Well, now that I've made your night, what would you like to kick around before we call it a night?
I think you've got to point out some of the objections to it. Dispersals of clouds and cloud formation and so on like that. Other pollutants in the atmosphere. In fact, just the noise from year to year over shadows, what you've seen so far.
There are a number of objections to this from the scientific community, let alone the present administration. Okay, the scientific community is wondering about the negative feedback potential of a cloud formation. That as you evaporate more water off the world's oceans, they form more clouds. The clouds reflect away the sunlight. You get a negative feedback loop. And there is no real good answer to that. Climate modelers will tell you that trying to factor clouds into their equations is the most difficult thing that they're working with. There are atmospheric chemists who will tell you that if you do, in fact, raise the atmospheric temperature a little bit, then the opacity of carbon dioxide is actually reduced and you get the greenhouse gases to go ahead and escape. But there's the opaque nature of carbon dioxide to infrared radiation is actually temperature dependent. Of course, my immediate response is, do you really want to go through that exercise? You know, find out for sure. But that is an objection as well. Another thing that is not at all well understood is the world's oceans' capacity to store carbon dioxide and how much more carbon dioxide you can put in the world's oceans and whether or not the world is busily engaged in that. Now, a lot of people, including some folks from MIT, are saying that this is a real possibility. I don't care that much for it because carbon oxides, carbon dioxide and carbonate, which is the CO3, have kind of a funny property when it comes to water. And many of you can relate to this in a certain fashion because you're old.